Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's plan to nominate three federal judges to the critical D.C. Court of Appeals, which many see as a challenge to the Republicans to filibuster the nominees they have routinely blocked. But this time, the Democratic majority in the Senate might bite back and employ the so-called nuclear option. Former counsel to President Nixon and best-selling author John Dean joins us to discuss the looming showdown on Obama's judicial nominees and the high-stakes rulings coming soon from the Supreme Court. Then we'll examine the good news from California indicating that as the states implement Obamacare through their new insurance exchanges, the price of premiums will drop dramatically due to transparency and free market competition. Ethan Rome, the executive director of Healthcare for America Now, a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states representing 30 million people, joins us to discuss why the Republicans are fighting the Affordable Care Act tooth and nail, which now appears to be because it will work and be good for the American people. Then finally, award-winning filmmaker Louis Schwartzberg joins us in the studio to discuss his latest feature documentary from Disney Nature, Wings of Life, narrated by Meryl Streep. We will discuss the film's message that life depends on little things that we take for granted, like the bees. Also joining us is Dr. Charles Benbrook, a professor at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University, who will explain the mysterious collapse of these vital populations of bees that pollinate the fruits, vegetables, and much of the food we eat. I'm now joined by John Dean, the former counsel to President Richard Nixon. Prior to that, he was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of a law reform commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition and Lost Honor, and more recently, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without Conscience, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches, and Pure Goldwater. He's also a columnist at Justia.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dean.
Hi, Ian.
And, John, it seems that speculation, for example, in the New York Times, is that the president, in putting up three nominees at once to fill vacancies on the 11-member United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, is, in fact, a strategy to basically challenge them to filibuster. Now, given that they've done this routinely and with the last nominee, he was rejected twice, but only a week ago they approved Sri Srinivasan to that court. How is this going to play out?
Well, I think that the Times is right, and I think it's pretty conspicuous what Obama is doing, that he is indeed going to put it up for an issue that's very conspicuous. Three judges, there are three vacancies on that court that are long, empty vacancies. He has been unable to get, he's gotten one of them filled so far, but they keep filibustering when he comes up with single nominees. Yes, after there was a lot of talk about employing the so-called nuclear option, which would change the rules of the Senate and prevent a filibuster by a majority vote and make the Republicans go crazy for doing it, because they wouldn't be able to filibuster these things then. When they started talking about that, Harry Reid started talking about that, they suddenly got three nominees through to make a show that they were, oh, yes, we're not blocking everything. Well, that isn't true. The strategy of the Republicans is so clear and so conspicuous. There are even subdivisions within the Republican bloc that are trying to block Republicans from doing their own thing. So it is just total obstructionism by the Republicans. So there's no question they're going to try to somehow defeat these three nominees, because the court right now, a very important court for the president, because they're slowly gnawing away at a lot of his important initiatives right there in the District of Columbia, which has jurisdiction over many of his programs. And the court is evenly divided right now, 4-4. In other words, there are four, I would call them, moderate to progressive Democratic appointees, and four solid Republicans, plus senior judges who can come in and sit on these panels who are all Republicans, who, if there were regular judges, they wouldn't be able to come in. So this court is just stacked against Obama, and it's causing a lot of havoc for his programs. So he's at last finally going to make a move and let the public see what the Republicans are doing. They're just not letting him have anything and trying to prevent them from doing more damage to the programs he's got.
Well, John Dean, it seems that that this has been going on for a long time. Even, one of the vacancies goes back to John Roberts, does it not? I mean, why is it taking him so long?
It's absurd, is it not? The exact scheme they're running is to try to prevent him from filling as many court seats as he can so that they eventually think that they will get back in power and that they can indeed appoint their judges again. The Republicans pay much more attention to judgeships than Democrats do. Obama is really not been very fast out of the gate in trying to fill a lot of vacancies he could have been filling. They've been very slow at doing it. They have gone sort of, step by step, and they're getting them knocked down, rather than the Republicans, who always seem to come in with their list ready, and they're actually a lot of, I'm sadly to say, a lot of mediocre judges that they will put on the bench that are pretty hard-line guys and not sure they'd get jobs elsewhere or be able to have much of a law practice elsewhere. There are a few good judges, but, too many mediocre judges are being put on the bench by the Republicans.
For ideological reasons?
I absolutely. Yeah. They are tested. They are shrunk wrapped, and they know exactly what they'll do and how they'll vote. And they are, Ian, when I look at a panel, particularly at the appellate court level, where you have decisions that can be more influenced by ideology, you look at the size of the makeup of the panel, and if there are two out of the three typical appellate court panels that are Republicans, you know exactly how the decision is going to go. And it's become almost, 99.9% predictable.
Well, John Dana, perhaps what happened here was that given that the Republicans have been denying his not just his judicial appointments, but he's also his executive branch appointments as well through filibusters, as bad as that is, and the capricious use and constant use of the filibuster, which has changed the entire nature of government in a way that's pure usurpation of power, but some reason or other they've sort of the Democrats have been taking it on the chin for some time. But when this same court that Obama is trying to fill now turned around and cut and dismissed his recess appointments, which is the only mechanism he has to get around their obstruction in the first place, you'd think, boy, that must have gotten his attention.
We'd hope. It's also interesting that Harry Reid, when the new Congress was formed in January of this year, and that is the time that the rules of the Senate are voted on, and everyone agrees in the Senate that is the time that the rules can be voted on. He refused to bring the filibuster issue up to what he's now talking about, the nuclear option, is to have a majority vote of the Senate at any time can change the rules. Well, he could have avoided that problem, that he thought, well, somehow I'll get around it. The Republicans, Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, made noises that I will cooperate. We will stop all this obstructionism. And, of course, they just did 180 from that, but they sort of head-faked Harry Reid into going along with this. And some of the younger Democratic members of the Senate who've been working on reform of these rules were really disappointed and crushed for their efforts that the majority leader, Harry Reid, wouldn't bring it up for a vote. And they're now paying the price. So, it looks like maybe they're starting to get all on the same page and realize that the Republicans will destroy this presidency by inaction. Also, they can make this an issue for 2014 elections and just show the people, they've got to do something about this Republican obstructionism.
Well, John Dean, again, former counsel to President Richard Nixon, prior to that chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of a law reform commission and associate deputy attorney general of the United States, the author of a number of best-selling books, the latest of which are Conservatives Without a Conscience, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative and Judicial Branches, and Pure Goldwater. He's also a columnist at Justia.com. There are some very, very high-stakes rulings coming down soon from the Supreme Court on same-sex marriage and affirmative action. And of course, the court that we've been talking about, the D.C. Appeals Court, feeds both important cases and justices to that court. So its importance can't be underscored.
They also, interestingly, feed law clerks. It's the principal source of law clerks come out of that court as well.
Right.
But curiously, it appears that what they've done is released all of their unanimous decisions where they've all been able to agree on everything, have gotten those all out. The opinions that are going to come are not likely to be much unanimity as there has been in the last six rulings that have come out of the court. So I think it's going to be some rougher sledding here. It will be very interesting.
So you mean you're talking about the same-sex marriage, affirmative action, the Voting Rights Act? That's a really important
all one. All of the biggies are still yet to come, the ones that will really have an effect on America. Some of the pro-business rulings surprise me that they've been able to get unanimity on them, but that shows how centrist this court is. And how, in essence, it is a pro-business court, even for many Democrats that sit on there that are appointed by Democratic presidents.
Well, that would be the Monsanto case, right? It was almost
exactly
unanimous against a farmer who he didn't exactly steal the seeds. It just
just planted them.
Yes, exactly. So when you talk about John Dean about the 2014 elections. If the court rules, particularly if they strike down the Voting Rights Act, or at least the part of it that refers to the South, there were so many mendacious efforts to bring about to return of kind of Jim Crow laws like poll taxes, etc., which were prevented by that very, I think it's Article 5 or something in the Voting Rights Act. That would be pretty tectonic, wouldn't it? I mean,
it's hard to tell, Ian. For this reason, the complexion of the South has changed fairly dramatically over the last few decades since the Voting Rights Act went into effect. I actually worked on the 65 Act when I was in working as minority counsel of the House Judiciary Committee, and I've watched it over the years. And while there are clearly areas that it should apply and needs to still apply, I'd say many areas that it could be lifted. Maybe this Congress doesn't agree on nothing, can't even decide where it'd be appropriate to lift it, and actually some jurisdictions it should probably be added to. But, I can't tell you overall. I've seen a few studies that are a little uncertain as to what the impact will be. And it's one of those things we'll have to, I think that there's a high possibility they will knock it down. They've been itching, and it'll be a very slim 5-4 decision. But they are determined to upset virtually all of the election laws. They've certainly done it on the finance side, and now if they get into something as basic as reapportionment and what's discriminatory and what is not, they've pretty much ignored a lot of the tactics that Republicans are now using, and they haven't been able to get much standing before the court to hit these. So we're in uncharted area here.
But everything that you just mentioned, John Dean, seems to be at the end of the day a reflection of what most people found shocking about the Bush v. Gore ruling, which was the naked partisan nature of it. I mean, Citizens United has clearly benefited the Republicans.
Well, they say they're not partisan, but of course, they're victims or captured. I shouldn't say victims. They are captives of their own philosophies, and their judicial thinking is so parallel to their political thinking that in effect they become partisan calls. It's the way they see the world. They don't necessarily think they're being partisan.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way they view the world, and that happens to have a very partisan impact. And that's the whole story of polarization today, where we have a country that we have people who see it one way and others who see it another way, and the twain has not met in recent years, and in fact drifting further apart.
Well, I don't know that the gridlock and the poisonous nature of this political standoff and the dysfunctional nature of our government is equally shared, and the blame is equally shared. It seems to me that the Republicans are either tactically or emotionally just being bloody-minded here.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not talking about their tactics. I'm talking about their philosophies.
Right.
There are people who just are differently built from one another, and their philosophies as to how to deal with government are very different. And the Republicans now, who feel they can't do anything other than obstruct and block, are using the only tactic they have. They don't have a majority, but they have a significant minority that can really tie up things. For example, there are certainly more Democrats, but the way they have drawn the district lines in states, they now have a sufficient number to control the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a minority of people in the United States are now controlling one body of the Congress. They can do the same with 45 senators in the Senate. And that's how they implement and obstruct is through it's sort of tyranny of the minority, if you will.
But people like you, I guess you're a recovering Republican.
I've been an independent for a long time.
Right.
I don't even understand the tribe I used to belong to.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But you're not alone here. Former Senator Olympia Snowe, who just quit recently, responding to questions about what former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole said. She said, "Yeah, I agree with Bob Dole that the party should be closed for repairs."
Exactly. I think it's beyond repair. I'm kind of hoping that the Tea Party will take it over, and then the Republican Party might reassemble as some new body because the Tea Party controls it today. And that's the tail really wagging the dog.
But so do you think then that this could become a kind of issue in 2014? Do you think as much as the American people are polarized, there's also, I think, a good body of people. And after all, the very Republicans that we're talking about that you just suggested might have to form their own party.
Ian, there are enough independents and moderate Republicans that you could indeed take control of the House again. While they have they have redistricted in a way that Republicans can dominate, and this happened right under the nose of the Democrats who let it happen at the state level, and now the redistricting plans are in place, and until they're either overturned by courts or we go through another census and have another redistricting wave, but there are enough that if people get their senses about them, they can indeed put the Democrats back in control of the House. And I think that's what Obama is trying to do with these three appointments we're talking about, is start to at least to show people that this is an impossible situation. You can't have this kind of dysfunction and run a country. You know, now, the financial markets are more afraid of Washington than anything else.
You don't have to convince me. It's broken government. You wrote about it earlier, and it's become even worse than it did when you wrote your book, Broken Government.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I thank you for joining us, John Dean. Appreciate
it. Always a pleasure, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with John Dean, a former counsel to President Richard Nixon. Prior to that, he was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of a law reform commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition and Lost Honor, and more recently, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without Conscience, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive Legislation and Legislative and Judicial Branches, and Pure Goldwater. He's also a columnist at Justia.com. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the good news from California, how the new insurance exchanges under Obamacare are lowering the cost of premiums dramatically.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor,
my... Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ethan Rome, who's the Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states representing 30 million people. Ethan Rome has been a grassroots and labor activist and organizer for more than 25 years and also worked as chief policy and political advisor to the Connecticut Speaker of the House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ethan Rome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And here in the state of California, the health exchange that's being set up, it turned out that just over this weekend, the nation's largest health insurance exchange basically has set straight the record on what's going to happen with health care reform and what's going to happen with Obamacare, as they call it, if it's implemented. And this is incredibly good news, right, that the premiums will go down. That was the whole intention. So good news for Californians, but what about the rest of the country?
Well, it's great news all the way around. I mean, of course, it's great news for Californians, but it's also great news for everyone in this country because California has set a standard. It just shows that when you give consumers choice, when you put plans up against each other, when there's a fair competition of plans, consumers get a better deal. And the other thing is that when you think about what the Republicans, the opponents of this plan, have been saying, they've been saying one thing after another about how it's going to be more expensive, it's going to cause this problem and that problem, and this settles it. This makes clear that every time the Republicans talk about Obamacare, what they say is not true. And the truth are the most important things, which is what's actually happening.
So in other words, the socialist without a birth certificate Muslim imposter has actually come up with a really good capitalist plan that gives you free market competition.
Well, geez, that is a lot of, those are a lot of big words, Ian, about all kinds of isms. But yes, absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is that this plan is working. It's working. And that's the thing that's most important. And the other thing is that when this news about the rates in California came out, right? That affects a large number of people, 7 million people in California who don't have insurance, but every single person in California who does have coverage, if they have a pre-existing condition, they don't have to worry anymore about losing their job, getting denied coverage, going bankrupt because they can't afford their medical bills. And those are the parts of Obamacare that don't get talked about enough, but they affect all of us.
Well, meanwhile, of course, the Republicans in Congress have voted to repeal Obamacare 37 times, and I'm sure there'll be further votes on it. So at what point does their mean-spiritedness come out? I mean, they do have a lot of people who believe, because of the propaganda, that this is terrible socialism that's going to deny them choice and that they're going to be subsidizing a bunch of freeloaders. That's the sort of propaganda that's been out since day one. But as the evidence mounts that the reverse is true, do you think at some point or other the Republicans are going to look mean-spirited, that they don't want to protect the health of at least 25 million Americans who are able to, for the first time, obtain affordable health care insurance?
I mean, I think for them, they're making what I think is like their last stand electorally, based on the idea that people will somehow think that they're better off on their own, up against the insurance companies, with no rules whatsoever, than they are being banded together with their fellow neighbors. And that's the thing. It's like when we talk about this law and the mean-spiritedness of the Republicans, we have to remember there's 129 million people across this country who have what insurance companies call pre-existing conditions. And they can drop us. They can deny us care. They can charge us whatever they want. They could do all of that prior to this law. Now, the Republicans, God bless them, 37 votes in the House, it's an extraordinary thing. 15%, a full 15% of the floor time that they've spent in the United States Congress is on repealing a law that's going to change everyone's life for the better and is also, as Speaker Boehner has said, the law of the land.
So, Ethan Rome, again, Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states representing 30 million people. Do you think that one of the reasons then why the Republicans have had this jihad against Obamacare and their nominee for president, of course, said the first thing he'd do if elected president would be to repeal it? At the state level, they've done everything they can to sabotage it. And you've got the state of Texas doing everything that they can to stop it, quite the opposite of what's happening in California. So does this really come down to perhaps that what the Republicans most fear about it is that it will work and it'll end up being like Social Security, which is an incredibly popular program?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and it's very simple, right, that I mean, the Republicans, their entire extremist ideology is about advancing private markets at the expense of people, giving rich people tax cuts, making the rest of us pay, and doing so in the name of how government doesn't work. Except people know that it works when it comes to Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. And so what they hate, what they absolutely hate about this program is it's going to work. And it's another example of why it's so important to have good government. It's an example of what happens when government comes together and people of good faith come together and develop a program. And again, we're talking in this instance about making health insurance better for every single person in the United States who has it, and then also giving access to affordable coverage for people who don't. And, and by the way, at the end of the day, you know, the Republicans bet against capitalism, and they lost. And they lost to the insurance companies, because that's who submitted the rates in California, and those are the rates that are lower than anyone that expected.
So the process is basically, in terms of the countdown to the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, in October, the exchanges will supposedly be complete at the state level, and then by January the 1st of 2014 is when all of the country will be adopting, and that's the whole point, isn't it, that if everybody buys into these state exchanges, then you have a group, a pool, which would therefore lower the cost for everybody. And it seems to me that what the Republicans are hoping for and their friends in the insurance business are hoping for is to do what they can to prevent this from happening and for the pool being as big as it should be and could be. What's the prognosis then in going forward to January the 1st of 2014 if some of the insurance companies can hold over some of their healthiest customers for a whole year? Apparently there's a loophole that allows them. So are those loopholes going to be closed? Because the idea that that even in the law itself, there's room to maneuver to manipulate and sabotage the implementation is pretty shocking.
Well, you know, there's always room in every law. In every law, there's always some loophole or something or another. You know, I think that what's important to focus on in this case is the fact that that the exchange is going to be open for business, and you're going to have millions of people who are able to shop and get better coverage and at better prices than they've ever gotten. And that's what the insurance companies are going to spend their time on. They're going to spend their time wanting to get into the exchanges and attract customers. And again, when we talk about this law, I constantly say to folks, it is an extraordinary life-saving thing that people who don't have coverage are going to be able to get it for the first time. But for all of us who do, January 1 means no more discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions. No more annual limits, lifetime limits. I mean, that's one of the things that we've seen. I mean, when people talk about the health insurance crisis, people have forgotten all about that because we just talk about Obamacare all day long. But a couple years ago, what we talked about was that there's people who go without health care because they don't have coverage, and there's middle-class families going bankrupt because they do, but it wasn't the coverage that they thought. And now, right, we're fixing all of those things. And so that's why I think it's always nuts when the Republicans are campaigning against Obamacare, because it means that they're going up to every senior citizen and saying, hey, if you're getting discounts on your prescription drugs, I'm against them. I'm a Republican, and I'm here to help.
Well, again, I guess it comes down to the rollout working, the exchanges working, the inability of the Republicans to use legislative tricks to sabotage it. They're going to try everything they can up until its implementation. But at the end of the day, in 2014, if the Republicans are going to run against the Affordable Care Act, Obama's going to have to run for it, isn't he? And he's really going to have to roll up his sleeves and get tough and make a strong case.
Absolutely. But, I think that's what he did in 2012. And I think that's what every candidate did, and I think that's what folks are going to do going into 2014. What the Republicans are going to do is they're going to continue to try to make this a surrogate. They're going to try to make this the playing field around which they get to have their fight over all the ways in which everything related to government is bad. And the only problem is that their idea of government is giving tax breaks to rich people who don't need it. And our idea of government is bringing folks together and using it to create policies and programs that help the greatest number of people. And so, you know, the thing that's amazing to me about the California rate announcement is it's really simple. It's government in action, right? You want to know what Obamacare looks like? Look at California's rates.
Well, Ethan Rome, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ethan Rome, who's an executive director of Healthcare for America Now, a national coalition of more than 1,000 groups in 50 states representing 30 million people. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with the filmmaker of an amazing new film that shows the beauty of nature and how much it's threatened, along with a leading expert on the extinction of bees.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
I see skies of blue and clouds of white, bright blessed days, dark sacred nights, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Well, Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Louis Schwartzberg, who's an award-winning cinematographer, director, and producer, who for three decades has created breathtaking imagery for feature films, television shows, documentaries, and commercials. He's won two Clio Awards for Best Environmental Broadcast Spot, an Emmy nomination for Best Cinematography for the Discovery Channel special Oceans of Air, and the Heartland Film Festival's Truly Moving Picture Award for Walt Disney Pictures' feature film release America's Heart and Soul. Louis pursued a lifelong fascination with nature, running time-lapse cameras on flowers continuously 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for over 35 years, and spearheaded by the emergence of colony collapse disorder, the abrupt, inexplicable disappearance of entire worker bee populations from their hives. In 2005, he began a feature film about our relationship with plants and pollinators. This latest feature-length nature documentary, theatrically released worldwide by Disney Nature, is Wings of Life, narrated by Meryl Streep. And also joining us by phone is Charles Benbrook, who's research professor and program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Louis Schwartzberg and Charles Benbrook.
It's great to be here.
And let me begin with you, Louis. You have provided us with this extraordinarily beautiful tableau of nature, and it's obviously something that all of our children should experience. And the film seduces you in the sense that it is about this seduction, this love affair between bees and butterflies and plants. And then later on, we learn about the extraordinary importance of what we've seen as this, you know, festival of beauty. But there's a deep reality to it. And then, of course, the recognition and the realization that this whole cycle of life could be threatened. So it's an amazing, amazing film, and I thank you for it. You got started back in 2005. That must have been when people were first getting aware of this problem of what's called colony collapse disorder.
Yeah, when I heard about the issue of colony collapse disorder, it really motivated me to make the movie, because I've been shooting, as you said earlier, time-lapse flowers for almost 35 years nonstop. And you can't tell the story about the bees without telling the story about the flowers, how they co-evolved over 135 million years together. And this intricate, seductive relationship is at risk of unraveling because of man's, you know, input with things like, you know, pesticides and loss of habitat and stress on pollinators. And it's by far the most critical issue, I think, facing mankind at the present moment. But in order to tell that story, I really wanted people to fall in love with this incredible, beautiful, intricate, seductive relationship called pollination. You know, plants don't have legs. They can't move around to mate. So they've evolved this amazing strategy of seducing pollinators to move their pollen around, their DNA around, in order for them to reproduce. And, you know, without plants, we wouldn't have a third of the food we eat.
So, in other words, the fact that plants, and particularly flowers, are so colorful, that's a part of the seduction, right? That is what draws the pollinators in, so that the stigma and the stamen meet, or whatever, I can't remember from my biology class.
Yeah. Well, I've been fascinated by beauty, you know, and you kind of wonder, like, well, why are all babies cute? Why are kittens and puppies cute? I think that nature has hardwired us to protect what we fall in love with. And what the flower's strategy is, it's color, it's taste, it's smell, all these seductive, you know, tools to manipulate the pollinator to come and land on it and move its pollen around so that it can, you know, reproduce. It's an incredible, fascinating story, and it makes you appreciate the fact that it's the little things in life that make the world go round. It's the foundation of life on our planet.
And there are a lot of kids, of course, inner city kids, for example, who think that food comes from supermarkets. We have kids here in L.A., in South Central and other parts of L.A., that have never even seen the ocean, right, 10 miles away. So as a teaching tool, what are you hoping? Because Disney's put out a teaching guide, have they not, online?
Yep.
Just explain that to us.
If you go to Disney.com, there's a 36-page study guide, and they've taken the same storytelling device that I did in the movie, which is basically I tell the story from the point of view of the flower. So we don't have this sort of, you know, anthropomorphized view on the outside looking in. It's from the flower's point of view and the pollinator's point of view. And that way, I think it really makes you understand and feel what it's like to be a flower or a pollinator.
And it doesn't hurt to have Meryl Streep narrating it, saying that she is the voice of the flower, right?
It's really great because she's obviously a wonderful actress and most celebrated actress of our time, and also an English graduate student, so that she was very, you know, and a great gardener, I should say, as well. So she really loved working on this movie. And in addition, on my website, movingart.com, I've listed a lot of things people can do to help the pollinators, including some webinars we've done with different universities talking about the issue of pollination.
And you did a TED Talk, right, about this as well.
Yeah, we did it. I did a TED Talk, and what was really amazing is that the montage of that TED Talk went viral, and we've got over 30 million views, which is like six times larger than a number one box office trailer. So clearly, there's an audience out there that's interested, that wants to be seduced by all this beauty, and obviously, it's an important issue that we care about.
Let me bring in Charles Benbrook, research professor and program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. Chuck, give us your scientific reason. We've heard the artistic reason for why we should be engaged in understanding both the beauty of nature and how nature is being threatened in this very most fundamental way. Give us the science, if you will, around this mysterious colony collapse disorder.
My pleasure. First, let me say to Louis, I'm really looking forward to seeing this film, I'll tell you. Well, you know, people have heard the adage for many years that you have to watch out for canaries down in wells and mines. Well, you know, the health of our pollinators and bees are an equally important indicator of, you know, really what's going on at the interface between agricultural lands that are managed by farmers and often treated with a variety of production inputs and wild creatures that share the same ecosystem. There is something profoundly disturbing and worrisome about colony collapse disorder. The extent to which it has emerged as a global threat to pollinators is, you know, it's virtually unprecedented in our time to have such a critical problem appear seemingly out of the blue on essentially in most of the continents of the Earth. So it's a truly profoundly worrisome development, and I think what is behind it is the cumulative impact of a number of changes in how farmers manage their crops, but in particular how farmers control pests and the use of a certain new class of insecticides called the neonicotinoids, or nicotinols for short, has. You know, there's accumulating evidence that shows that it's the emergence of all the ways that these nicotinols are being used by farmers that has kind of constituted the straw that broke the camel's back. One of the things that I'm sure Louis gets into in the film is how this is not just about the health of a single bee that goes out and is drawn by the beautiful bright colors of a flower to serve the pollination needs, but it's about this remarkable superorganism that is a beehive. A beehive is much more than the sum of the parts of all the individual bees that make it up. And I think what science is finally unraveling is the ways in which routine low-level exposures to a variety of chemicals, but in particular these nicotinols, can and does disrupt the integrity of this superorganism, which is a beehive, in ways that incrementally undermine the vitality and the ability of the bees within that hive at any particular time to deal with all the other sources of stress and bacteria and viruses that are a normal part of their environment. So this is an extraordinarily complex story that's unfolding, but certainly one we ignore at our peril.
Well, my understanding is that last year, half of the bees died off in the United States. Isn't that catastrophic? I mean, something's happening not just on an extraordinary scale, but happening quickly.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, obviously no one claims to have exact numbers on the percent of hives that are impacted, but typically beekeepers, you know, expect, you know, 15 to 25% of their hives to run into trouble over the winter and have to replace about that many. But since the emergence of colony collapse disorder, that average has kicked up to around half. There's many experienced long-term successful beekeepers that have lost 60 to 70% of their hives in over a single winter. So there's clearly something new and profoundly serious that's eroding the integrity of these hives.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to add one thing, too, because, you know, Chip Taylor, who's head of Monarch Watch, reported that this year that the monarch population is the lowest it's ever been in 20 years since they've been monitoring it. And a lot of that he attributes to, you know, GMOs, the fact that these kinds of pesticides and GMO seeds are being spread throughout the Midwest is decimating the monarch population.
Well, there is a connection, is there not, Chuck Benbrook? It was sometimes in the demonstrations that took place against Monsanto over the weekend around the world, there was some confusion about the herbicides and insecticides. But my understanding is that even though it is mostly the Bayer insecticide, the neonicotinoid that has raised some flags and been the focus of concern, and that Roundup and other things are herbicides, which Monsanto produces. But my understanding is that Monsanto seeds are actually coated with this Bayer insecticide, this neonicotinoid. Is that your understanding?
Well, it's not my understanding. It's the fact. Essentially, all commercial corn, soybean, cotton, sorghum, wheat, seed that's planted every year by farmers, and whether they're genetically engineered seeds or not, but essentially the entire conventional seed supply today is treated with at least one nicotinal insecticide. These are potent and persistent systemic insecticides that actually move into the plant and are carried by the plant's vascular system. In effect, it's the blood system, circulatory system of the plant carries these nicotinols up through the architecture of the plant as it grows. And as a matter of fact, when a corn plant germinates from a seed treated with clothiodine or thiamethoxam, the two primary nicotinols that are used as seed treatments today, the concentration of those systemic nicotinols is highest in the first couple months as that corn plant grows. And what happens is corn plants, and indeed all plants, in the morning, they emit what's called gutation droplets, which it's in effect, people have termed it as plant sweat. It's a way that plants remove toxins that build up inside of them. It's a totally natural part of the plant cycle. But it turns out that these systemic insecticides that come from the seed treatments are being emitted by the plants in these gutation droplets, which happen to be favorite early morning sources of moisture for worker bees that have spent the night fanning the queen, working all night to preserve the integrity of the hive. They go out in the early morning, they're tired and they're thirsty, and they love these gutation droplets because, A, it's water, but, B, it actually has some nutrients that the bee needs from the nutrients the plant has pulled up from the soil. So this is a favored source of drinking water, but unfortunately, over the last 7 or 8 years now, across the United States and in most intensively farmed regions of the world, it's hard for a bee to find a field that hasn't been treated, where the seeds haven't been treated with one of these nicotinal seed treatments. And I think that it's this exposure through the seed treatment use that has really brought about the global scope of this, because it's not just corn and soybean and cotton seed in the United States. It's most of the seed in Europe. It's most of the seed in South America. It's the seed in the Far East. So it's really all over the world.
Well, it seems, though, that we're in a sort of deadly cycle, if you will, in terms of our chemical dependence on, or agriculture being chemically intensive, I guess is a way to put it, with both insecticides and herbicides being used in greater amounts. And my understanding is that the analogy is with human use of antibiotics, that the more indiscriminately you use antibiotics, the more likely you get antibiotic-resistant strains of TB, etc. So isn't that happening too? I mean, after all, it all comes down to Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, we are subjecting the weed populations in the United States. I mean, there's 185 million acres being sprayed with glyphosate herbicide this year. That's most of the corn, most of the soybeans, most of the cotton, significant chunks of other crops, alfalfa and sugar beets, where there's Roundup Ready varieties available now. So, you know, we're talking about over half of the farmland in the United States will be sprayed with glyphosate at least once, and probably it's pushing 1.75 applications per acre on average. So a lot of acres are getting treated twice, and some are getting treated three times. So the resistant weed populations that exist out in those fields, there may be only a few dozen resistant weeds in an acre, but those weeds will survive, and they will produce viable seeds. The water hemp plant and some of these other plants, they produce 200,000, 400,000 seeds per plant. And the rate at which they can spread is just really mind-boggling, especially if farmers continue to subject the growing population of resistant weeds to continuing selection pressure by still applying glyphosate herbicide, which is, of course, what farmers really have to do, because when they go to their seed dealer to buy corn seed, to buy soybean or cotton seed, all of the varieties, essentially the entire seed supply now, has embedded in it this Roundup Ready trait. And so in a way, farmers can't go to the marketplace and change their buying patterns and manage their way out of this. They have to rely on the seed industry proactively deciding that they're going to expand the supply of non-Roundup Ready seeds so that farmers can start to reduce their reliance on glyphosate herbicide, which is the underlying cause of the spread of the resistant weeds in the first place.
And Louis Schwarzberg, again, the filmmaker of this extraordinary feature-length nature documentary released by Disney, Nature, Wings of Life, narrated by Meryl Streep. The film begins with a reminder to us all that life depends on little things we take for granted. And just listening to Chuck lay out the science of what we're taking for granted and how much it's threatened, this couldn't be more important. This is not, I normally cover international relations and national security, but there is you could make an argument that what is more fundamental to our national security than the security of our food supply?
You can imagine there'd be more than an environmental, disaster. It's economic chaos. If a third of the food disappeared off the shelves, could you imagine what that would mean economically or politically, even to every country in the world? So I do believe that, and I agree with most scientists, this is the most critical issue facing mankind, bigger than global warming. If we lose this miraculous win-win relationship that evolved over 135 million years, we're never going to be able to recreate that. Even like the giant you know, greenhouses that grow like 1/6 of the tomatoes we have in our country depend on a bumblebee to pollinate. And even agribusiness, with all the pesticides they're spraying out there, they still have to truck in bees, which, you know, in order to pollinate these flowers. We've got, we shot at an almond grove up in Tehachapi. It's like in the middle of the Mojave Desert, 10,000 acres of almond trees. That's a very unnatural thing. And the flowers bloom in February for like a week or two. They got to truck in millions of bees to pollinate these flowers, because if they don't get pollinated, there's no almond. So it's a billion, multi-billion dollar economic impact to the state of California and to countries around the globe, that if the bees go, business goes, and we go.
And just in closing, Chuck Benbrook, do you see this in that kind of apocalyptic light?
Actually, I do, if nothing fundamental is done to start to reduce the incrementally greater reliance of farmers on more and more toxins to get crops through the season. It's just there's going to be a breaking point. You know, it's going to be bees, it's going to be birth defects in babies, it's going to be loss of a number of wild species. We have problems with the bat population for probably a lot of the same reasons. These nicotinols impair the immune response in all sorts of different organisms, from bees to bats, and so we have to take a fresh and unbiased look at what modern science has done to the our agriculture production systems. Yes, the yields have gone up tremendously. Yes, we, you know, one farmer can manage hundreds, if not thousands, of acres of cropland, but the underlying system is really in jeopardy. And just one really critical point, as I'm sure Louis gets into in the film, imagine the difficult time the U.S. population would have, approximately doubling, if not tripling, its consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables, which we all need to do to combat overweight, obesity, and diabetes, are three major public health problems in the current generation. Imagine what a bind we would be in if we had to try to import most of our fresh fruits and vegetables from parts of the world that had not decimated their bee populations. It would be, as Louis pointed out, it would be true chaos.
Well, Charles Benbrook, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Benbrook, research professor and program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. And I've been speaking with Louis Schwartzberg, who's an award-winning cinematographer, director, and producer, who for three decades has created breathtaking imagery for feature films, television shows, documentaries, and commercials. Louis has pursued a lifelong fascination with nature, running time-lapse cameras on flowers continuously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for over 35 years, and spearheaded by the emergence of colony collapse disorder, the abrupt, inexplicable disappearance of entire worker bee populations from their hives. In 2005, he began a feature film about our relationship with plants and pollinators. This latest feature-length nature documentary, theatrical release worldwide by Disney Nature, is Wings of Life, narrated by Meryl Streep. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.